send chills right through me when I look at you, 'cause you're my thrill. You're my thrill.
We'll let Eric go first. The youth shall go first.
Well, Eric, why don't you tell us a little bit about what you do at Two Morrows?
Right now, actually, I'm kind of doing sort of what I was doing several years ago, part-time anyway. I started with the company back in 2000, started working there part-time, and that's about 2 or 3 months I went full-time. And I was just doing, I was basically the staff of the, I was the only one person besides John and Pam in the office. And I was doing everything from proofreading to taking orders to filling orders and sending them out and scanning, doing a lot of scanning. I probably scanned about 1,500 Kirby pages of pencils.
Oof.
All the Xeroxes that you see in the Kirby collector, I scanned probably 2/3 of them. And that was my full-time job for a while, and I was also working part-time in a newspaper. I stopped working full-time at Two Morrows in, 2006, I think, and just still doing the freelance thing, which is kind of, I'm doing both now. I got laid off from my newspaper job last year, so I'm back working at the office part-time, kind of filling your orders and doing that kind of thing again. But also, you spend my freelance time, I'm doing design work for John, as well as the Modern Masters book series and other books that I do with Jim. That's kind of where I do mostly. Have been putting out on an average about 4 books a year, so that keeps me pretty busy.
Just to touch on the Modern Masters, how long does it take to put a book together generally?
Well, it really varies. Depending on, I try to be as flexible as possible to work with the artist's schedule because, you know, they're not making a lot of money off these books, so I work around their schedules. So, you know, some guys I do, you know, when I'm doing my interviews, I generally do about five hours worth of interviews for each book, and so that might be broken up over, you know, 4 or 5 weeks, or it might be broken up over 5 or 6 months, depending on the schedule, on the artist's schedule. So, but once I have everything and have all the art, you know, it takes me a couple of weeks to transcribe and edit everything, and then about 2 or 3 weeks to do the design work on it. So, I mean, once I have everything, it doesn't take very long at all to put the book together, but it's just that process of getting it all together is what takes so long. And the research, you know, I do a lot of research. I try to read as much as I can from that the artist has done, and, you know, try to get a, you know, I have a list of questions that I write, of course, and then I you know, go off on tangents as well, but yeah, so that research time, it varies too, but you know, that's another 2 or 3 weeks of, you know, off and on preparing for the interviews and everything too.
Right.
So.
Right. Okay. Well, Jim, why don't you give us an idea of what you do with Two Morrows?
Well, I was one of the early subscribers of the Kirby Collector. Actually, I met John Morrow in the summer of '85. He was upset that I used to put on a comic book conventions when I used to be manager at Acme Comics, and we had Jack Kirby as a guest in '85, and John came in the shop like a couple of months later and was like so depressed that he'd missed him. And I didn't see John. That's the only time I'd seen him until, you know, almost 10 years later. Nine years later was the next time I saw him, when he was doing the Kirby Collector. Yet I remembered him because I remembered his great disappointment at missing Kirby. It's funny that you can remember a one-time meeting. But anyway, so I would contribute to the Kirby Collector. I contributed some to a comic book artist. A lot of times John would, you know, call me up because I had 9 years as a retailer, you know, and get my opinion and things like that. So, but I've never worked for him in the way Eric has. I've always just, you know, freelanced. And then I started doing interviews for Alter Ego, and Roy quickly made me an associate editor. And as Roy says, that means I get to associate with the editor. So that became immediately, you know, the main writer in the interviewer, and that was actually I started doing that in January 2001. Although my work didn't actually start appearing until November of that year. And I've been doing that since. And, of course, you know, I've done five books through Two Morrows, and Eric and I have done three together. So I did the John Romita book with Roy Thomas, and Eric and I have done a book on Sal Buscema, a book on Carmine Infantino, and obviously the Matt Baker book. And I did the Quality Companion with Mike Koyman.
I'm trying to think which I of those I have the Romita book so far, but the others I have not been able to pick up yet.
www.tomorrows.com. I couldn't resist the plug.
Yeah, no, that's fine. We want people to check out the.
You get a 15% discount on anything that Tomorrows publishes there too. By the way.
Well, that's even more of a reason to direction check there.
A number of their books and magazines also have digital editions. As long as we're getting the plug in, might as well do it all.
Yeah, you might as well.
Let's move back to the Modern Masters, because it's a series that's been, I think you have, what, 27 volumes out? 28?
Well, there's, 27 volumes have been released, yes.
Yes. Ah.
Yeah, Darwin Cook still has not come out.
Okay, but it is.
The interviews are all done. I'm just waiting for him to finish getting the art together. He just got married. A while ago, he moved it the year before that, so he's seen all that in his work schedule. Things just kind of got out of hand, and he hasn't been able to get the art, finish getting the art together. But one of these days, that'll happen, and the book will get out. So I've got the number reserved for him still. So
when I talked to some friends of mine that I was going to be interviewing you, they did ask about the Darwin Cook.
Yeah.
Book, so they will be.
I get asked a lot.
I think I
even asked him.
Yeah. I think at the con where we set this up, I think I asked you.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah.
Whether it was coming out, so I figured when you skipped over the number, I was like, okay, that's got to be.
Yeah.
That's got to be a good sign.
One of these days, I'll finally get all the art together, and then like. Once I have all the art together, it'll take me about 2 or 3 weeks to finish it off, and then it'll be out. So.
Now, these artists live all over the country or all over the world. Getting the art together, I guess that means that they have to provide it.
Usually, yeah. For the most part, I try to get as much artwork directly from the artist as I can. Occasionally, I do get stuff from collectors or heritage auctions. Has been very helpful as well, because they scan everything they auction. And they've been kind enough to let me go into their archives from time to time. So,
wow.
You know, one of the nice things about fans, there's a lot of fans who are very, very willing to help supply, you know, copies of original art, or at least if we need, you know, if there's no art exists, obviously copies of, scans of comics that artists did and things like that. And, and most of them are very, very willing to always help. Which has been a blessing for us, you know.
Oh yeah. Well, that's the thing too with the Matt Baker book. I've got two stories. Well, actually three stories completely run in original art that we got from collectors. So we got one of the stories from the Heritage Auction site, and then the other two stories came from some collectors from the Comic Arts fan website. So. I've met a lot of guys through that website, comic art fans, and got a lot of help from those guys over the years.
Do you find that saying that you're from Tomorrow's, do you think that helps? I mean, because the company's been around long enough to build up a track record.
Yeah, actually, for a while, actually, on comic art fans, they would post our previews of the magazine for a while. They were doing that. So I think most of them know who we are. So that doesn't hurt at all, obviously. I mean, occasionally you come across people who, you know, don't know, but
right.
So but for now, the most part, they're at least familiar with the name. So yeah, it doesn't hurt. Certainly.
Generally, if people who collect art tend to have a higher degree of interest in comics history than fans who just follow Wolverine or Batman. I don't mean it in a disparaging way, but it's just the way it is. So a lot of them, you know, do have the advantage. We have the advantage knowing that this is. Of Tomorrow's, and in my case also because I'm a comic book artist, and some people know me from that, and some of them collect my my work too. So, it and Eric's got now so many books under his belt. It's like, much easier to get attention when they know who you are.
when I first heard about the series before it started, I was like, oh, okay, well, you know, who do you consider to be a modern master? And then, you know, some of the early artists, you know, Art Adams, Alan Davis, John Byrne, Walt Simonson, I was like, okay, that's a pretty good run there. And then I don't think I've seen one name on there where I really sort of questioned, you know, the decision of, oh, I wouldn't put, you know, so-and-so in with that with that run. And you've been, now, when did the first volume come out?
2003 was the first one. So we're coming on the 10th anniversary in March of this year.
So 10 years, 28 books. Yeah, I can't think of one that I was not even just like disappointed in, but I can't even really think of one where I was just like, yeah, I don't see.
Yeah, well, that's good. I mean, I can't say you're the everyone's has European. I have been questioned from about certain people and certain artists from time to time.
Really?
You know, on message boards and stuff, I see people like, why are they using him? You know, but you know, everyone has their own little preferences. So I try to mix it up and try to get different guys. Basically, I'm more interested in storytelling than anything else. So if you can draw a pretty picture, that's not necessarily enough. I need someone who has a voice and who has a style of their own and who can tell a story in a dramatic fashion. And you know, a lot of the guys that I've covered, you know, not only pencil and some often ink, but a lot of them write as well. So probably half the guys I've covered have also written comics. So you know, I'm looking for storytelling above anything else. And
but even artists who don't write their own material, like Kevin Maguire,
sure,
you know, known primarily, I guess, almost exclusively as an artist, that still getting to sort of look into the mind of him as an artist and stuff is really kind of a fascinating, irregardless of the fact that you just get to look at all this great Kevin Maguire art.
Well, sure, yeah.
So you have the Modern Masters series, and then for Tomorrow's, you guys also have sort of not Modern Masters or like spotlights on
other
artists like Marie Severin or Gene Colan. I guess what's the criteria of saying not necessarily who's a Modern Master and who's not, because I'm sure there's just sort of a date range where you're like, okay.
Yeah. My date range is pretty much post Neil Adams. That's kind of my cutoff.
So late 70s, maybe?
Early to mid 70s. I think the oldest guys I've covered are George Perez and Walt Simonson. They're probably like the earliest guys.
Okay.
Yeah. Jerry Ordway.
Jerry came in a little bit later than that.
Yeah, I remember seeing his work around 83.
Yeah. So that's kind of my where I cut the modern part off.
Okay.
You know, so.
And I guess going the other direction, you know.
Well, I've recently done some fairly younger guys, like Fraser Irving's probably the youngest guy I've covered. But I generally want to have them to have at least, you know, my initial idea was to have at least 10 years in the business.
Okay.
To become really into your own, you have to have that body of work to develop and grow and become the artist you can be. There are very few people who can right off the bat, you know, are completely there, you know. So, and I've covered some guys like Bruce Timm, who's done very little comic work, but he's been such an influence in the comic industry as a whole that, you know, I think that's...
So it's a flexible.
Yeah. There is some room for flexibility there, but, yeah. My guidelines are pretty, pretty sketchy.
Again, I don't want to sound like a broken record, but I'd say it's been a success.
Well, thank you.
Is there anybody you can tease coming up?
Well, yeah, actually, I just got the cover about an hour ago from Cliff Chang for his volume. He'll be the next volume.
Oh. Has that been announced?
No, it has not.
Oh, okay. Well, exclusive.
Yeah. I'll probably be posting this cover on Facebook later today, but but you'll be the first person to have any kind of official announcement.
Although this won't post until after the Facebook announcement.
Yeah, that's true.
Exclusive for me.
You're pretty close. Pretty close.
Transcribe real quickly.
Exactly.
It's not gonna happen. it's interesting you mentioned Cliff Chang because he was sort of shooting from the hip there, but he has interestingly enough for an artist, he has an editorial.
That's true. Yeah.
Background. He was one of the like he was like a Vertigo editor, wasn't he?
Well, he was in D.C. I'm not sure. He was an assistant editor.
Right. He had some D.C. editorial.
Yes, he did have some work on the editorial side, yes.
Which really surprised me because you don't usually see that type of career progression.
That's true, yeah. And I didn't do the interview for this one. Chris Arendt did the interview for this one.
Ah.
But I believe that, obviously Cliff has an art background before he became, but for some reason when he broke into D.C., he broke in more in the production side. And then kind of went into editorial, and then became a freelance artist from that. So it is a very unique. I can't think of anyone else who's kind of done that same progression. But I'm sure there's probably been someone who's gone from both. I mean, like Shelley Meyer maybe. Well, I don't know if he started out in America, but he was an editor for a long time for National Comics.
Shelley started out as a cartoonist, but very quickly became an editor.
Right.
And then he was actually a cartoonist while he was an editor at Times, but then he got tired of being an editor and then went back to being a cartoonist, which was his first love. But no, he was a cartoonist first.
There's precedent for that kind of thing where you make that, you're in editorial for a long time and then go back to being a freelance or cartoonist. But yes. I think he's a smart guy too. He's really, I don't know if you ever met him, but he's a good guy.
Speaking of, I guess, editorial art crossover, before you joined us, we were talking about John Workman.
Oh, okay.
And I guess he would qualify with his.
That's true. Yes. Yeah. Although he was an artist before that as well.
Yeah.
Yes. Yes. John started out in production.
Yeah.
At DC, Carmine hired him and Bob Smith, I believe, on the same day. And so John was in production, and then he went from production, into lettering,
right.
and he had done some cartooning and illustration as well, before he got to heavy metal.
Mm.
Yeah, he did some stuff for, I don't even remember. I'm actually working on doing the design for Star Reach Companion for Tomorrow's currently, and John did some strips for that as well, where he wrote and illustrated those strips.
Mm.
John had done some undergrounds in the 70s, too, I believe. Yeah. I believe he did a couple.
Because he was an art director.
Yes.
So I guess that's maybe a little more on the sort of the usual, I guess, career path for an artist. I just remember hearing the Cliff Chang thing and looking back at some of the DC Vertigo. I think it was Vertigo. Seeing him on, like, Transmet or something, like some completely out of the way. If I saw his name, I was like, that's got to be the same guy.
It is.
I mean, how many Cliff Chang? And it's, C-H-I-A-N-G, so I mean, it's even, I was like, that's got to be the same guy. I mean, come on, what are the odds?
Yeah.
So you said that Chris did the interview for the Cliff Chang book.
Yes.
What's the deciding factor between sort of somebody else doing the interview or you? Is it if somebody pitches maybe the idea for the Modern Masters to you or?
A lot of times, yeah, that kind of happens. I get several people pitching ideas for me, but a lot of the time I'm doing them myself, just because kind of what I do. So,
right.
But there's some times where they might have a previous
an in, basically.
Well, not necessarily an in, but a previous relationship with them, like with the Lee Weeks book. Tom Field had been friends with Lee Weeks for years and years before he did the interview. So when that kind of came up, it was like, oh, here, that makes sense. Mm. Or like with Todd DeZago and Mike Waringo. I had talked to Mike about doing the Modern Masters book, and he had kind of like, oh, I don't deserve to be a Modern Master. He's like the most modest guy. He was the most modest guy ever.
Oh,
I said, Todd's like, well, what if I did an interview with, I think I could talk him into doing this.
Yeah.
Yeah, great. So in that kind of case, it was like, okay, yeah, if you can talk him into it, great. I'd be more than happy to let you do the interview. So, and I've done couple other books with Todd since then, it's just kind of how my schedule is, and if a lot of it has to do with just timing.
Are there any pie in the sky artists that you're like, oh man, I'd really like to?
Well, like one of the big guys, but the third person I ever asked to do a Modern Masters book was Mike Mignola, that was at the time he was just getting into production on the Hellboy movie, which hadn't been announced at that point, so. His schedule was kind of crazy, and about every once a year, I email Mike and or call him up and ask him if he's ready to do the Modern Masters. And he's like, maybe in about 5 more months, call me back. You know, it's one of those things where you just kind of
okay.
It's just kind of the eternal, maybe in 6 months from now, yeah. Kind of thing.
Well,
so,
it's not a no. You know, he's
exactly.
Not turning you
it's not
down.
A no. It's
okay.
Just it's just not a yes.
Right. Well, hope
yeah.
Springs eternal. So,
exactly.
You know.
Yeah. Yeah.
Anybody else?
Well, I mean, there have been a few that I asked and they just turned me down. So
okay.
I won't go into names or anything like that. But most of the guys I really wanted to when I first made my initial list,
mm-hmm.
I've covered most of them. So. Darwin Cook, of course, I want to finally get that out. That would be a good one. I mean, there's new guys coming up. I'm looking down. It's like, well, what if they've been around for a little longer and we have more to talk about?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, like some of the guys I really like now, Javier Peludo and Marcus Martin, I think are outstanding. Gabriel Ba, Fabio Moon.
The brothers.
That,
yeah,
they're outstanding. So those guys, you know, once they have a little bit more work we can talk about, I would love to get them in the series. And there's other guys who I would love to get in the series, but they already have a book, like Paul Pope. You know, I would love to get him in the series, and I'm hoping, you know, maybe down the road to get him. But, you know, he's got that Paul Pope, and he's just he's doing a new version of it. So, I mean, it's kind of like redundant to do. So, I mean, like some of those guys, if they've had a book out recently, you know, like Jim Starlin, at one point we were going to do a work with him, but you know, he already had a contract with somebody else. It's like, well, okay, I don't want to be redundant. There's so many other guys I can cover that don't have a book. You know, I'd rather get those guys first. You know, with tomorrow's, you know, so much of the focus of the general company is on, you know, the Silver Age and the Golden Age. And, you know, those guys, you read some of their interviews, and you know, Jim can attest to this. A lot of times they just don't remember anything.
Yeah.
So what I want to like get these guys in print before they forget everything. get it while it's still in their minds, you know. So.
Oh yeah, I can tell you all about that. But you know, it's funny. In fairness to these guys, some of the people I've interviewed hadn't thought about this stuff in 50, 60, in some cases 70 years. So, you know, it would be hard for them to remember everything. They've moved on from comics. They've done other things with their lives in some cases. And, you know, so if you ask them, you know, something that happened in 1941 and you're asking them that in 2005, it's, you know, you can't expect them to remember everything. What you want them to do and what you hope they can do is at least, you know, the people that they remember who died before anybody was caring about doing interviews, that they would remember them enough to tell you a little about them so we can at least still get someone else's biography in part two. And also, if you can get them to remember anything about – what I find about the Golden Age people is they tend to remember – they don't remember individual stories very – they seldom do.
Mm-hmm.
They remember the companies they worked for, and often they remember who the editor was. Not always, but most of the time they do. But you run into someone like Al Jaffe, who has a near photographic memory. And Al started at Timely as a freelancer, and then he freelanced some while he was in military service on the Second World War. He came back on staff, and then he became editor at Timely. And then he went back to freelancing, and then later, of course, to MAD. So he covered a lot of ground, and luckily, because he was in several different versions of employment at Timely, which became Marvel, he and his memory was good. He could fill in an awful lot of blanks. So when you run into somebody like him, you know, that's gold. But you know, it varies. A lot of these people, when they left comics behind, they left them behind, and some things just don't stick in their head.
And that's the other thing, too. I want to say about Jim's interviews for Alter Ego is, you know, sometimes you hear grumbling, like, you know, why do they interview this guy? No one's ever heard of him. Well, a lot of times they have the best information because they actually remember something.
Right.
Right.
You
know?
So,
right. Right. What I found is more often than not, the so-called little guys, the guys who weren't big stars, I tend to have only better memories, but I think that some things were more important to them because they were the guys that were scrambling for jobs more often, right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, if you're in like Flint at DC, certain things might not matter to you as much because you know you had a steady job. But for a guy who was scrambling from company to company, it was more important for him to remember who was in charge at what place, and who did he meet there, and what did he have to go through. And I think it sticks in their brain more, and that's why the regular average, you know, working comic book artist remembers more than some of the stars do. Because I've been asked, the only criticism that I ever had was when I interviewed so many people who, because a lot of people I interviewed never even signed a single comic book story. And some people would say, well, why did you interview him? And I'd say, well, Will Eisner's been interviewed 1,000 times. You know, Jack Kirby's been interviewed, you know, hundreds of times. After a while, it's hard to get anything new out of them. Mm-hmm. But a guy who's never been interviewed, whether he's a big star or not, you know, all these little guys, you know, and I like to say, I hate to use the term little guys, and
right.
So we put it in quotes. You know, they did a lot of, some of them did a lot of comics work, and they helped build up the comic book business as much as the big guys, because the big guys could, Kirby, as great as Kirby was, he couldn't draw everything.
Mm-hmm.
Alex Toth couldn't draw anything. Gil Kane couldn't draw everything. So, you know, the regular guys who may not have been as good as the stars, they're important too for that reason.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, when you're doing history, every voice counts. And I think that a lot of these people who weren't remembered and never could be remembered because they never signed anything, they deserve to be remembered for what they did. Because I think I made no distinction when I interviewed people. I've interviewed about 200, I suppose, maybe more. I'm not sure. I make no distinction on class as far as their standing in the pecking order of comic book history, you know, either in writing or drawing. What I care about is their story. When I finally did interview Will Eisner, I tried to cover areas that he never went into very much depth, which was quality comics, because people were so interested in the spirit or his graphic novels or the Eisner Iger shop, which was one of the first, you know, comic shops. But nobody went into detail with quality the way I did, so I could do an Eisner interview that was different than somebody else's. And otherwise, there would have been no reason to interview Will Eisner, because I didn't want to repeat something he'd said 1,000 times.
Right.
But Bill Ferraccio, who always only worked for small companies, he was not a great artist. He knew it, by the way. It didn't bother him. He did the best he could. But he ought to be remembered because he did a ton of comic books in the 50s, in the 60s, and his work is in a lot of comic book collections. He did a lot of work at Charlton Comics, and a guy like that deserves to be remembered.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And I think that's one of the reasons I like Tomorrow's and one of the things you guys are doing with your books and your publications is filling in the periods of comics history that aren't maybe, you know, as flashy as some others. And honestly, I started talking about the Modern Masters because that was more sort of the artist that I grew up with. But
right. With
books like the Matt Baker book, I really had no idea about Matt Baker at all. Even before this book, I'd heard his name mentioned a couple of times in the shop from some of my older friends who were more art collectors and art aficionados. When they heard about the Matt Baker book, they're like, oh, this is a big deal. I was like, okay, why, you know.
Right, exactly. To digress for just a moment, I interviewed Major Malcolm Wheeler Nicholson, founded what became DC Comics.
Mm-hmm.
Was originally National Allied Publications, and we knew very little about him. I mean, one of the most important people. He helped start new comic books being published. And I don't mean reprints of old comics. He was the publisher of the first comics that had all new stories in them. And we weren't even sure of when he died or what his story was. And I interviewed the family. I feel like that and Matt Baker are the two most important interviews that subjects that I have done in all the interview subjects I've done, because we need to know, you know, who was this man that started DC Comics. In the case of Matt Baker, he wasn't the first black comic book artist. He was certainly the first really good one, the first one that really broke through.
Mm-hmm.
He was very influential, and the only reason he doesn't become famous is over half of his work, the majority of his work was never signed, and he, unfortunately, he died young, and which is, you know, a tragic thing. But I felt like, and a lot of us felt like, there was a big gap in our knowledge, because nobody knew when Matt Baker died. There were people who said, oh, his work was appearing in some places and for Gold Key in the 60s. Well, that wasn't so. He had a couple of things that appeared later in companies, but he was already gone by then. Nobody knew where he came from or this, but his influence was keenly felt, even by people. And he influences people today who probably don't even know they were influenced by him, because he set a standard that a lot of people followed and still do, I think. And I think that Matt Baker is important for more than the fact that he was a great black comic book artist. He's important because he was a great artist. I think first and foremost, that's the important thing to me. Because, you know, the people reading those books didn't know the color of his skin. It was unimportant. What was important is, was he a great storyteller? Yes, he was. Could he adapt styles? Well, yes, he did. And who drew better women than him? Well, no one I can think of off the top of my head. So, and like I said, he influenced a generation, and I think that if he had been healthier and worked into the 60s, if he had lived, I think that style, he could have adapted to the Marvel style. Now, he would have been one of the big guns in the Marvel ferment of the 1960s. That's my opinion. He was influential. He wasn't just some guy who drew in the trenches. He started out that way because most people do, but he broke free and with great style. I mean, it seemed like there was nothing that he couldn't draw and make it look easy. And I think that his artwork had a point of view that, you know, also, I mean, when he was working for the Jerry Iger shop in the 40s, he was doing all the big busty girls, you know, with, you know, like the Phantom Lady, you know, for instance. There was tons of Jungle Comics that he did, and his style was, you know, really, really impressive and really eye-catching. And then when the 50s comes along, he is working for St. John Publications, and he changes his style. And he becomes more urbane, you know, more sophisticated, more Madison Avenue type of a look. And it was perfectly suited for the romance comics, of which he did hundreds. And he could adapt that style to the crime comics. He did westerns. And by the way, he also was an art director on some of the St. John magazines. For about a couple of years or so, in 54 and 55. And so he actually did editorial also.
Yeah, that probably would have lasted longer if Archer St. John hadn't passed away.
Right, right. His St. John's son took over, and apparently that was the beginning of the end for that part of the company. But, you know, he came from very humble beginnings, he rose to near the top, in my opinion. That's why he matters. You know, now there's a hardcore cult following for Matt Baker, and what we wanted to do was to enlarge the following and make people aware of who he was, so we reach a broader audience. Say, look, this guy was important, and you know, and more people need to recognize him. That's something we keenly felt.
Well, that's a good transition. Let's start talking about the actual the book itself.
We originally did some of the stuff you see in the book appeared in one form or another in the issue of Alter Ego that we dedicated to Matt Baker. Mm-hmm. Like my interview with Fred Robinson, who was Matt's half-brother, and also Matt D. Baker, who was Matt Baker's nephew. Mm-hmm. And so that interview was in the book. Some of the art that we use in that alter ego is in the book, but a bigger size so you can see it better. Not to mention all the new art. Alberto Beccatini did, you know, a timeline of Baker's career and a checklist, and it was heavily revamped by Alberto, by me. Haynes Ware pitched in. Jim Vadaboncour worked overtime to, you know, help make this as complete as we were able to do that. One of the problems, and so some of the things from the alter ego have made it into the book, but for the most part, it's totally different form. You know, it's not a repeat. Neither one of us feel we've expanded everything. So that's the and I had always wanted to do a book on Matt Baker, and of course Eric did too, and when we were talking about who we were going to do, Eric and I, we knew early on we were going to do a Matt Baker book. We just took a little time to get there because we spent a lot of time on the Carmine Infantino book, mm-hmm. and it delayed getting started on Matt Baker. But it was always our intention. We knew that Matt Baker might not sell as big as Carmine Infantino because more people know Carmine. More people know Sal Buscema. But I think that Matt Baker's importance, you know, is such that he deserved a book, and I think that now people can see for themselves, you know, why he was influential and why he was important, and that's what we wanted. We wanted to do that for him because we felt like he deserved it.
Well, I mean, I've actually got the book right here in front of me, and looking at it, you know, this book I think really does make a very strong case for him, you know, as being a major artist.
Right, and he was a force. And he was elected to the Will Eisner Hall of Fame in 2009, by the way. And it was long overdue, but there are a lot of people, you know, it happens. There's always someone long overdue.
Mm-hmm.
I think also the fact that there was so much mystery surrounding his life that mm-hmm. added to a little mystique to the story. And we were able to strip away some of the mystery and say, okay, it's not so mysterious now, but the art is still great, isn't it?
One of the reasons I wanted to interview you guys was I think the audience for this podcast skews rather young or towards the modern era. And when I got this book and I was looking at it and I looked at, you know, even just some of the figure work on the cover, and if I had to make, I mean, this is, again, my unprofessional opinion, if I had to look at his figure work, I was like, God, this guy looks like almost like a Dave Stevens.
Yeah.
Of the,
yes.
You know, like the Dave Stevens of the 50s. I was like, how did I not know about this guy?
You can see Adam Hughes in there, too.
Yes. So one of the reasons I wanted to have you guys on to talk about this is to be able to, have people who may not, you know, not even people who may not know, but I mean people who really just wouldn't even come across this to be able to say, oh, maybe I should, Matt Baker, maybe I should look at that. And then just, I mean, even the cover, looking at it, just being like, wow, that's very, you know, like you said, Adam Hughes or a Dave Stevens, and wow, that looks, maybe to modern eyes, some of the work of like the 40s and the 50s, some people may look at some of that work and just be like, yeah, you know, it didn't get good until Kirby, or it didn't get good until like EC, or it didn't get good until those sort of things. But to look at the Matt Baker stuff and be like, wow, here's somebody of this, you know, of this era, just look at that figure work. I didn't really have the words to you know.
Yeah, that's part of the reason we let off the book with a few comic stories.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that was one of the things I wanted to mention. I mean, usually you would have the reprints. Well, I wouldn't say usually, but I mean, I would think you would have, because you do have like some complete stories reprinted here. You would think they would go towards the middle, like maybe a color signature in the middle or the end. But here, I mean, you don't even have a title page. I mean, you just, you know, you have sort of the cover flap, and then boom, Phantom Lady right here on page.
Yeah.
You know.
We wanted to kick off, you know, we figured if someone picked up the book and said, mm-hmm. oh, that cover looks kind of interesting, maybe. Because, like you said, most people who walk into the comic shop aren't going to really know who Matt Baker is.
Right.
So if they see that cover and say, well, that's a pretty girl in there.
Yeah.
And you look it up. If they open that front page and see that Phantom Lady, oh, yeah, I think I've seen Phantom Lady somewhere before.
Yeah.
That we're hoping that would get them drawn in. You see that those stories at the beginning, it's like, oh wow, this is pretty cool.
Yeah.
And then you get to the book, and then, by that point maybe they're sucked in. So that's kind of why we wanted to kick off with the stuff he's best known for, the sexy girls, you know.
Yeah.
So get some full stories up there up front, where people who are just casual glancing up on the shelf,
mm-hmm.
they pick it up and get sucked into it and realize, hey, this guy's pretty good.
Yeah.
For me, my era is 80s. 90s, you know, 80s, 90s, almost 80s, 90s and today, but now 80s, 90s, 2000s and today. But being able to look at this, I can see people that were either influenced by him or influenced by people who were influenced by him.
Right.
And here on page 141, Baker sketched the shapely figure for another Iger Studio artist, Lee Ames. I mean, I'm looking at that sketch, and not only is it gorgeous, but I mean, I look at some of the facial work, and I'm thinking, you know, Paul Smith is probably, you know, somebody who was influenced.
Could well be.
And I can see the connection between now and then much clearer than maybe some other artists, where you see some of the work and you're like, yeah, like it was good for its time and it helped lay the foundation for things that are coming up, but you need to sort of appreciate it on its own. And this artwork that I'm looking at, both through the comic stuff and the sketches and the other art that you have in here, you don't need to make an exception for it. This is good for right now.
That, That's right. You hit upon an important point. The fact is, his legacy has long outlived him, even through people who don't even know they were influenced by him. I mean, you know, people were influenced by Kirby who didn't even know they were influenced by Kirby. The same is true of Matt Baker. And the people who look at this book who are not familiar with Matt Baker, but they might be familiar with, like we were saying, Stevens and Adam Hughes, will go, oh, now they have a frame of reference for what they like and why they like it, because now they have a precedent that they were unaware of. And in that way, we hope to it helps educate them, it helps inform them, and it helps give them, something to hang on to and why they like what they like also. So it covers, I think, a lot of different areas myself.
And I think another thing that makes his work stand out a little more from that time period is his layouts. I mean, he didn't just do the standard six panel grid that was typical of the time. He would do a lot of inset panels. He did a lot of breaking out of the panels. I mean, he wasn't the only one at that time doing that, of course. I mean, he had people that were quality, Lou Fine and Will Eisner, notably, doing the same kind of thing. But, I mean, that I think you see he was experimenting with layouts as well. So it wasn't just the standard grid that everyone else was doing at the time. So I think that kind of helps make his work seem a little less of the time.
You can look at different examples of the art and just sort of see different things, different strengths of him. So it wasn't like his strength was just gorgeous women. Yes, there were gorgeous women. However, there was also, like you said, some different, differing panel layouts. I mean, so many different strengths and different things that he could do well to have all of those in one person.
Yeah, I think you look at his romance work, you can see he had a great feel for acting.
Yes.
But then he's just as good with his comedic timing. You look at a strip like Sky Girl or The Canteen Kate, and he's got great comic timing as well. Mm-hmm. He can keep it beautiful, the beautiful girls there, but he's still got that great timing with the comedy, which is not everyone can do.
Right.
But he was very versatile.
There's never a dull moment in a Matt Baker story. There's never a dull panel. You know, we have a couple of examples towards the end of his career where he does some westerns for Stan Lee at what was about to become Marvel. And his style changes again. It's even more illustrative than the romance. And, he knew how to do the grit and grime, so you felt like you were on that dusty western street. So that's what I mean by adaptable. And I think that's why he would have adapted to the changing times in the 60s and beyond had he lived. But the fact that he could do that, and he made it look so effortless. I mean, that's talent.
Yeah, I should probably stop flipping through this book.
We want you to look through it. We want you to enjoy it. We want you to savor it. That's the whole point.
But,
we try to make a book, and Eric did the layouts, and of course did a great job. The book is structured so that you will savor every page. So there's something on every page that will draw and attract your eye to the man's greatness, and so it's a compliment when you say, hey, I should stop looking at this book, because that means you're so fascinated that you want to keep going through it, and that's the best compliment you can give us.
Oh, well, yeah. But looking at it while you're trying to record an interview is probably not the
best. That's all right. We can always...
All right, I'm closing. All right, I'm closing the book. I lost my train of thought.
But one other thing too. He was a very gregarious person in private, but when it came to being professional, he was all business. So not too many people got to know him, and that was another thing that, in a way, hampered his fame, because there aren't but so many personal stories about him to go around. And most people who worked with him in the Iger shop, he didn't talk very much. He just sat there and created magic at the drawing board. He didn't get into much of the banter or anything like that. But a lot of the Iger artists would look at him. Al Feldstein was watching how he drew. Jack Kamen, was looking at how he drew, and they became stars at EC Comics for your EC tie-in, by the way. And you can see in Feldstein's work, you can see some elements of Matt Baker, and you certainly see it in Kamen's work. They were, I would imagine, heavily influenced by Matt Baker, and he did it just by leading by example more than anything else.
Trying to remember, was there a reason why? I mean, Matt Baker didn't do any EC work himself, did
no,
he?
No, he was busy at St. John Publications.
Ah, okay, that's right. That's right. That's
you know,
right.
They were handing him all the work he could do.
Yeah.
You know, this kind of goes into another part of the book, if you don't mind. Hijacking you a little bit.
There was
an artist at Ace Publications whose work looked an awful lot like Matt Baker's, and nobody knew who he was. And it took a long time. You know, I talked to Lou Cameron, who was friends with Matt Baker, and he worked at Ace, and he remembered Matt Baker at Ace. I remember seeing him there. Maybe Matt Baker had made an appearance there, and Lou remembered it because Lou had a near photographic memory also. But it took a long time, but we finally were able to figure out, you know, who that artist was. And the artist was Frank Giusto, who was a friend of Matt Baker's. And obviously, they worked together in Iger's, and he was heavily influenced by Matt personally and professionally. And we were able to say, okay, those stories aren't by Matt Baker, but they, you know, at times they sure do look like it. And that's another nice mystery that we were able to solve. And so people who are collecting old comic books, you know, if you want to buy the Ace publications, they're worth buying, of course, but Matt Baker is not in them, and that was another thing we felt was very important, because we had always, Hames Ware and Jim Vadaboncourt had always dubbed him Ace Baker, you know, for Ace Publications, because we weren't sure. We thought perhaps Matt's brother John, who did some comic book work, although we've not been able to document it, I think probably he was just helping his brother from time to time.
Mm-hmm.
We thought, well, maybe Matt did layouts and John Baker did finishes, or maybe John Baker did it on his own and was influenced by Matt, and maybe Matt helped him or something. But it turns out that none of that was the case. But that was something that took a while to figure out, and that's another part of the book that we felt was important.
Yeah, and that was one of the reasons for the delay in the book as well. Once we got that interview from Sean Clancy did with Frank Giusto, and that added so much more to the book. We had to kind of reconfigure from there, and because we really needed to get that stuff in, because I mean, Ray Osrin, who's also interviewed in the book, and Frank Giusto knew Matt Baker better than anyone outside of his family, probably. So those interviews are very important as far as giving that fuller picture of what Matt was like, just in his private life, as well as his artistic life. So those were great additions to the book. And the other thing was the checklist. We're talking about how all these guys were so heavily influenced by him.
Mm-hmm.
When you go through Overstreet, you see all these question marks about Matt Baker drew this, or maybe Matt Baker drew this, or, you know, so we Jim Vadaboncourt and Alberto Beccatini, but a bunch of other people as well, but those two guys were the kind of the main force behind the confirming and denying what exactly in that checklist was actually
Matt
drawn
Baker
by Matt
done,
Baker.
Right.
Yeah, so you see a lot of commentary there where it's like Matt probably did pencils for this, and it was probably inked by Feldstein or Kamen, that kind of thing. So we've kind of done as much as thorough a job of getting what he actually drew into that checklist,
right,
and getting rid of some things that are obviously were not actually by him.
Right. Well, I'm looking at the checklist right now, and it goes from page 68 to, it looks like, 95.
Yeah.
So almost, I was told there would not be any math involved, but
yeah,
about 30 pages of.
It would have been a lot shorter without the artwork, man. But
true, but still,
there's
a lot of text on here.
You
guys really did a good job of putting together.
Because we didn't want to do just a portfolio,
because
you know a portfolio tells you about the art, but it doesn't inform you about the person who did the art. And you need more than that. You need context for it, and that's why the interviews are so important, and that's why the checklist is important, especially to people who are collectors, because, you know, there were so many errors in, you know, in the past of what Matt Baker did and didn't do. And I'm not going to say that we've eliminated every single error. We probably haven't, but there's some things that can't be determined.
Mm-hmm.
But we were as thorough as we were able to be. And but that's one of the reasons the checklist is long. But like Eric says, there's an awful lot of art in there, and in there to make it longer too. So the checklist is not quite as long as it seems. But yeah, the context of these things I feel are very important. That's why it's nice when I interviewed his half brother Fred, was because Fred could give us information that no one else can give us, because obviously being his brother, we wanted to know. We didn't know where he was even born. It turns out he was born not far from where I live now, but everybody just thought he was from Pittsburgh. I always thought it was kind of funny that I was born near Pittsburgh, and then I moved here to North Carolina, and Matt Baker was born near me, and he moves to Pittsburgh not far from where I was from, in almost a mirror image, which I kind of laugh about. But the important thing is you have the work, and you have context for the work, and you have context for the man.
Certainly this book does a good case of not only just, like you said, showcasing the art, but also saying this is who Matt Baker was, this is why he's important, not only just as an artist, but as a, as a person. So getting the art, like not only the original art, but also like the photo, because you have a fair amount of like personal photos and
most of them came from Fred Robinson.
Okay.
Most of the photos. And we were lucky because Fred actually sent me the original photos. He trusted me. And Matt sent a few photos. Matt supplied some art, and Fred supplied some art too. And we do want to say this book was sanctioned, and we were given approval by the Matt Baker Estate, and we're the only people they've given that permission to, by the way. And that's the reason why we were able to use the photographs that we were able to use, for instance.
Right. I'm still flipping through the book.
A lot of the stuff, like a lot of the personal correspondence you saw, Frank Giusto provided those for us. So we got a lot of stuff from Frank, and so that was another great reason for contacting him and tracking him down.
Right.
Getting all those great all that great art he put on those envelopes that he would make with
that was pretty cool.
Yeah.
You know, it's so funny because even though we had the interview, then we still weren't sure whether or not he was Ace Baker. And so when I talked to him, he was, I think, very glad to see that Matt Baker was getting some due. And then by talking with him, I was able to help finally determine, that he did all those stories in this. And he said himself that Matt did not help on those stories. So that was why we declaratively say that he was the artist on the Ace Comics things. But it was just nice to have had cleared up. But the nice thing is, all the people that we talked to were cooperative. All the people who gave us art, some of them were above and beyond the call of duty, and we just had really good cooperation for the most part. There were a few bumpy roads on that, but for the most part, everything But it just took time. We actually had other things in mind when we first started out with the book, and it became what it became now because Eric and I changed our minds on things more than once, but we tried to finally put together a book that covered a lot of different bases of the man.
How long did it take to sort of put this book together once you sort of got the go of like, okay, we're gonna do a Matt Baker book?
Oh gee, longer than it should have.
Yeah, it probably took 6 months just between the idea of us doing the book, the idea of doing the book, and actually starting getting work on it.
We had the idea for the book about 2006.
Yeah.
Right.
Maybe as early as that.
When did the Alter Ego article come out?
That came out in 2005.
Okay.
Then when Eric and I decided, hey, we are, because Eric and I had known each other several years, and we were already good friends. Then when we decided books, we had a list of people we wanted to do. Matt Baker was on the list from the very beginning. It was a little harder to do than we thought, and there were some delays. Some of them were personal, some of them were professional, some of them just things. Sometimes things just happen. But as you can't rush a book.
No. I was going to compliment you again that this book certainly worth the time that you guys poured into it, but I feel like all I do is you guys talk and then I compliment, and you guys talk and then I compliment. But going through through it. I mean, I'm on page, let's see, 118, and there's a picture of Matt Baker and Archer St. John in front of Mann's Chinese Theater, or what is now Mann's Chinese Theater. One of the things, this may be a little superficial, but Matt Baker was a good-looking guy. I mean, I mean, not only just, I wouldn't say, I mean, like almost movie star, sort of handsome, certainly a good dresser.
Oh yeah, all his contemporaries that we talked to, they would always, that would be one of the first things they would comment on.
Yeah.
You know, so
yeah.
A lot of comparisons to Harry Belafonte or to Sidney Poitier or something along those lines. You know, so
you know, you look at some of these pictures, that's no joke.
And I think that kind of played into his hand a bit, because you know when he was doing those romance comics,
mm-hmm.
you know, his fashion sense for those was outstanding. So.
Right.
I think that just added to his the quality of his work.
Yes, I mean, because he was up on style, so he did when he did romance comics, they were wearing away the styles, the men and the women.
Right.
And he certainly knew. Yeah, he was one cool dude. And that picture of Archer St. John, that was the first time
mm-hmm.
most of us had even seen a picture of Archer St. John. And by the way, it was unusual for an artist to be that close to a publisher, and that too set him apart from a lot of other people. But Archer St. John knew he had a star, and I believe they were friends beyond the work. I would imagine too. There was a lot of respect there. So, but that photograph, that's an unusual photograph to see a publisher with one of his artists, and they just have, and they're Grauman's Chinese, as it was known at the time. A majority of artists work, artists and writers never met the publisher.
Right.
Much less be friends with them.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, outside of the EC environment, that's completely atypical. So.
Yeah. I mean, you guys would have a broader spectrum of this than I am, but thinking back to the 50s, I think, you know, EC was sort of how it was, and you're like, well, that's how it was for, you know, 10 or 12 of them, but after that, it's very different, you know, a very different sort of working relationship.
And let me say this, too.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's one of the reasons Matt Baker was so successful at St. John. He had free rein, essentially.
Yeah.
You know, he had a publisher who trusted him. And look what he got back. He got back very sophisticated work that was above most of the crowd. And I think that level of trust makes Matt Baker an even better artist, because now he's free to be an artist and he doesn't feel any of the restriction that maybe somebody might have felt, you know, who might have never, you know, even met the publisher.
That's another interesting thing to speculate on, too, is not just, you know, what would have happened, you know, fame-wise if Matt had lived longer, but what if St. John had lived longer and Matt would have continued to do whatever he, you know, grow like that at that pace that he was growing with St. John,
with a publisher that was so supportive and
exactly
right, and it speaks a lot that Archer St. John was an extremely open-minded person. Some people, you know, might have even resented that their star artist might have been African American, but you know, but not him.
Mm.
He was open-minded, and all he cared about was quality.
Yeah, and once he passes away, you know, it's a bad time in the industry because the Comics Code and because of the distribution and all, advent of television and everything else going on that was causing the circulation of comics to dwindle.
Mm.
You know, Matt Baker fell on hard times after that and ended up ghosting for Vinnie Coletta, of all people.
At the end of his life, yes.
That, you know, really didn't know anything about Matt Baker before I was reading the book, and then I was, you know, looking through and learning about him, and then I came across the name Vinnie Coletta. I was like, I think I audibly gasped when I first saw that name. I was like, oh no, because it's, I mean, you know, seeing Matt Baker's work, you know, up till this, you're like, oh, it's so, you know, I'm enjoying it so much, and then for those of you who don't know, well, I guess maybe you should. Talk about it, seeing Vinnie Coletta's name, maybe some cause of concern for his work as an anchor. But,
well, he had trouble getting work, because once St. John, you know, folded the comics, Baker gets work from Stan Lee, but he doesn't get enough. And then Stan, in 1958, Martin Goodman had lost his distributor. And so they didn't even publish for about a month or so. And then when they were finally able to, they struck up a deal with Independent News, who was an arm and a big part of DC Comics. So DC Comics was Stan's distributor. Well, he was limited to 8 books a month, and suddenly there was no room for a lot of artists. So Baker had to scramble like a lot of people had to scramble. And however he got to Vinnie Coletta, or Vinnie Coletta got to him. We don't know how that worked, and unfortunately, there's no one to ask who would know. But he wasn't the only one. I mean, Joe Sinnott. When Baker died, Joe Sinnott becomes the Vinnie Coletta ghost there at Charlton too. So Vinnie worked his magic over Joe's pencils the same way he worked it over Matt Baker. But it was just a bad time. But I think Baker's fortunes would have turned around had he had the chance to live long enough.
Going back to that picture on page 118 reminded me of a question somebody wanted me to ask specifically about that L.A. trip. I've got it right here, so let me just make sure I phrase this correctly. The book of S.H. John, the publisher for which Matt Baker did much of the work. There's a photo of St. John and Baker in Los Angeles. Has the reason for that trip been discovered?
No. It might have been that, they went on a vacation together. Who knows? Mm. Maybe St. John's going to do something, and then, and for all we know, other artists could have been with him. We just don't know.
Okay. Huh. Okay. Well.
Yeah. I wish we did know the answer.
Yeah.
I know. But like I say, for all we know, 2 or 3 artists went with him. It could have been a group, or it could have been just the two of them go together. They were very good friends. But St. John was very good friends with Mary McDermott, who was an editor there, and Nadine King, who worked there as an editor, who I did interview for the book, but she didn't know the answer to that question. And so we're not going to get that answer either, I'm afraid.
Well.
It could have been a business trip with a little side touring while they were there. You know.
Yeah.
With Matt Baker being his art director, we're not even exactly sure of the time period when that happened.
Right.
Within several months. It could have been any time throughout there. So it might have been while he might have been there as his art director. So
yes.
On a business trip, we just don't know.
And it might have helped if it was like Eric suggests, and I would imagine Eric's guess is probably the correct one. That he might have gone in business. Well, let me take my art director with me. And who knows what they were presenting to whom? Because that happened all the time. Hugh Hefner offered Playboy, which was originally called Stag Party. He first offered it to Busy Arnold, Quality Publications, and Busy Arnold turned it down. So, which is something very few people know about. So, St. John could have been thinking about expanding his publication base to the West Coast, for all we know. And certainly there was enough West Coast money that had funneled into magazines and comics, over time and during those times. So it's not. I think Eric's hypothesis, I would say, is probably the best guess.
Hmm. Okay. Well, Kyle, there's your possible answer. We will never know.
Again, we don't know how he got to work with Vinnie. We don't know the circumstance. Most of the artists were New York based at that time, or maybe they lived in New Jersey or Connecticut, but they still are going to be in the city. Anybody could have run into anybody at any time.
Mm-hmm.
Perhaps Matt Baker ran into Vinnie at Timely. When Stanley quits. When they quit publishing for that time period, he got another distributor, and then Vinnie could have said, "Hey, I got this Charlton account, and I need someone to help me pencil or do the penciling for me." And Matt Baker's available. Matt Baker's he did work cheap. So that Joe Sinnott worked cheap. Joe told me that he got $10 a page penciling for Vinnie Coletta. Yeah, I know nothing. And at one point,
and even at the time, that was not a lot.
That was low. And then at one point, Vinnie cut him down to $9 a page. And Joe, quit not too long after that. So we don't know what Matt Baker was being paid, but you kind of have a guideline there of going by what happened with Joe Sinnott, who started ghosting when Matt Baker died. You see, so it was nothing, but you got to live. You got to pay your bills.
Yeah. Hey, $9 is better than zero. So.
Right, right. So, I mean, that's as much as we probably can know about that. So, now, you know, Stareko did visit the office, and he may have even assisted, you know, Coletta briefly during that time period. And he remembered seeing Matt Baker, you know, working in Coletta's studio in Manhattan. But he didn't get to know him, unfortunately. I wished he had.
Yeah.
So, you know, I don't know whether Jim would know the ins and outs of that. Probably not, but I could be wrong on that, too.
Speaking of which, there's another sharply dressed man.
Yes.
So when did Matt Baker pass away?
I believe the date there is 58, isn't it?
So, and not under mysterious circumstances, but again...
No, he had a bad heart.
But there was some question over, was it when he was born or when he...
Well, we didn't know that until we, that Matt, you know, Baker, Matt, the nephew Matt Baker, had the family Bible that recorded the birth and death dates, and that's the reason why we have those for Matt. Otherwise, we would have still been guessing, because you know Fred didn't know the exact date, but luckily Matt had it all written down for us.
Wasn't it Vinnie Coletta who had said Matt Baker hadn't died until 62 or 63 or something like that?
Well, he said 63. Some other people said something else. It was always nebulous. One person claimed he was killed in a knife fight in Harlem, which was I don't know how those kind of stories even get started. You know, I find that to be a terrible, terrible story. By the way, we ought to mention that how we even got in touch with the family. There's a guy named Rob Allen who on one of the message boards on the internet was contacted by Matt D. Baker, the nephew, and then Rob, you know, supplied me with Matt's information, and then I started talking to Matt, and that's how that all started. So we got to give Rob credit for being the one who had the first contact information for the family.
Yeah, Matt had posted on Comic Book Resources message board in the Classic Comics thread.
Oh.
And he was just kind of looking to see if anyone had he was kind of trying to get a feel of where his uncle stood in terms of comic book history.
Right.
And Rob Allen was one of the regular posters there on that. I was actually an irregular poster at that point on that thread. And Rob immediately
jumped on it.
Got hooked him up with Roy Thomas and went from there.
Right. Well, what Rob did was Rob sent some emails. He sent one to Roy, he sent one to me, and somebody, and two or three other people, and then we hopped right on it. By the way, now that I'm looking, Matt Baker was born December 10th, 1921, in Forsyth County, North Carolina. We don't know where in Forsyth County.
Right.
Okay. He died August 11th, 1959, in New York City.
Right. Well, it's interesting. I mean, you know, we live in the information age, and even though you almost have to take everything you see on the internet with a grain, if not a heaping shovel full of salt. It's interesting that we know so much about, you know, certain comic book artists or certain artists, but then we don't know anything about others. And you know, having access to so much information now, it's interesting to, you know, to have somebody like this, at least from my perspective, to have somebody like this sort of pop out of nowhere.
Sure.
It's good to have, you know, the job that you guys have done collecting all this information on somebody as important as Matt Baker. He can go from Matt Baker, artist on It Rhymes With Lust, artist on, you know, Canteen Kate, to, you know, having this 192 page book where we get to have art samples and all these interviews and history and everything to be able to flesh out who he was and why he's important to comics history and important to, you know, modern comic readers as well.
Well, I mean, that was the hope of the book, you know,
right,
just
right.
To try to, you know, put him where he belongs in the grand scheme of comic book history. So
I think that kind of covers everything for the Matt Baker book. I did have one other a question I needed to ask about a tomorrow's book. I don't know if it's pending or it was something that was, I guess, mentioned.
Are you going to the Jim O'Hara book?
You know, I am, actually.
It was solicited at one point.
Okay.
But it wasn't the previous catalog at one point. That was many years ago. Yes, it is still in progress.
It is still in progress.
Yes. I'm working with a new writer on it, Todd DeZago, one of my collaborators with Modern Masters, I believe next week, actually, doing the interview. He's going to visit Mrs. Apero at her home in Connecticut, and we'll be doing some interview there, and hopefully they can get some going through the art files there. So we are making some progress on it, finally.
Okay.
I won't even go into all the details of why it's been delayed so long, because it's
okay.
From my side and from the writer who was first, the guy who was first helping me with it, it's some personal things with the not between each other. It's just his family issues. There's some health issues, and my wife had some health issues at the time. It was just a terrible timing, and then between that and Jim passing away right before we started doing the interviews, it just kind of it was just a bad thing, and so it kind of threw everything off the tracks for a while. But I've got some other guys collaborating with us. George Corey's going to be who I've done some Modern Masters with.
Ah, yes.
He's done some other books for tomorrow. He did the Alan Moore book and the
yes.
Shimoda book, the American Man Companion. He's doing an article on for it, and Jim may be contributing to it. I'm not sure. We haven't quite nailed that down yet, so we need to be finishing that.
Me?
Yeah, you.
Yeah,
we've got to make some finalizations on exactly what Jim's participation is going to be for the book, so we can get. I'm hoping, you know, I dread saying any kind of possible release date, because I've said it two or three different times and I've had to go back on my on it over the years. But I'm hoping, depending on how things go with the interview, what we can get out of Mrs. Apero,
mm-hmm.
what she remembers, that kind of thing. If everything goes well with that, we should have a late summer release this year, hopefully.
Ooh, well, I'm knocking on my wooden desk.
See, part of the problem with Jim is kind of similar with Matt Baker in that
mm-hmm.
no one really knew him that well.
Really?
Really. He didn't go into the office very often.
Huh.
He worked, you know, from his home most of the time and would call people with work. And he got into the business so late in life. I mean, he was in his 30s when he finally started working for DC.
Huh. Now, what was his sort of what was the range of his career like date wise? Like, obviously, I mean, he worked up until you know what, the late 90s, really, early 2000s,
mid to
so?
Late 90s, yeah.
But mid to late 90s. When did he like when did it start?
His first comic book work. I mean, he did a little comic strip for a local newspaper for a couple of years ago called Stern Wheeler. He tried for several years to get into comics, and he could never break in until he finally broke in with Charlton Comics, the late 60s. His first, I believe the first thing was the Go-Go.
Mm-hmm.
Does that sound right, Jim?
Yeah.
When he was doing a little humor strip with a ditzy blonde kind of character.
Mm-hmm.
And very different art style from what he would later use with DC. So he started there, and I don't remember the exact year off the top of my head, but it was 67, I believe, was the first release date of his professional work. So, yeah, and then he went from there to doing the Phantom strip and some little horror stories for Charlton and some romance stories. There were a couple of romance stories and some covers here and there. When Dick Giordano moved over to D.C., he brought Jim Apero along with him, among others.
Mm-hmm.
So that's kind of when he became known, really.
And again, just personal, he was, in some ways, maybe my favorite Batman artist. It was during the Starlin Batman run that I started reading Batman. So in some ways, when I think of, it's sort of hard to say this because, I mean, so many people draw Batman, and, you know, people say, like, Neil Adams and stuff. And certainly, I appreciate the Neil Adams.
Yeah.
But no, for me, there's always a soft spot for Jim Apero, Batman. And then that's later on, I discovered like his Aquaman stuff, looking back on it.
Oh, yeah.
It's like, oh, wow. You know, wow, look at that.
Yeah, I'm a little bit older than you, so he's my Batman artist, too,
mm-hmm.
But from Brave and the Bold.
Ah.
yeah, so...
Yeah.
He was the first artist whose name I knew and would look for. That was when I was 4 or 5 years old, I think. I got an Adventure Comic with his Aquaman work in it. From there on, he was my guy for a long time. He was my favorite artist.
I'm assuming this book will be more, obviously, something closer to like the Matt Baker book as opposed to something like the Modern Masters, since you're not going to be able to have a direct interview with him. It's going to be more of a collection of interviews with, you know.
Yeah, it'll be essays and some interviews as well. Yeah, interspersed. But I think it's probably more essay than interview, actually, once we get everything done. Then there'll be little testimonials from people who did work with him and things like that. So there is some of that as well. There's a great little story from Joe Staton that we'll have in there too. But
good.
So yeah, it'll be closer to the Matt Baker than modern, much closer to the Matt Baker book than the Modern Masters books.
Oh yeah, and artwork. This would you be going through collectors and stuff to sort of pull together?
Oh yeah. Well, Spencer Beck was Jim's agent, his art dealer, and Spencer sent me a whole box of stuff that he had Xeroxed for years. I mean, unfortunately, most of it's from a certain period on up, so it's not a lot of the older stuff. But there was a little bit of the older stuff, and I was able to get some things from other collectors as well. So it'll be a mix of things, but most of the artwork I've gotten from Spencer, who had access to all Jim's files at a certain once he became his agent. So
it must be a pleasant change from the Matt Baker having to although for artwork and stuff, if I remember from the book and what you guys have said, you got a fair amount of it from
the family and from Craig Giusto himself. So yeah, we got a big chunk of it. But the stories, they came from various places and certain other parts. Like I said, Heritage Auctions, well, a lot of the single pages came from there. So it wasn't, and actually, I contacted maybe a dozen or so collectors to get fill in a lot of the holes and get some of the prime stuff. There's surprisingly a lot of his artwork out there in the community, in the art collecting community. You don't generally find a whole lot of Golden Age stories floating around, but I mean, there were several complete stories, in collectors' hands, so which was surprising and very, very nice, a very nice surprise. So,
well, let's see. The Matt Baker book obviously is out.
Yeah, you can get it through the Tomorrow's website, or you can get it through Amazon or any of your finer comic book establishments. Or if you prefer buying it through Barnes & Noble, if they don't have it in stock, they can certainly order it for you. They can look up the ISBN number and order it for you. So it's widely available. If you can't find it, just Google it look for it, and you can find it.
If you can't find it, you're not trying hard enough.
Exactly. if any of your listeners are kind of on the fence on it, you can go to the Tomorrow's website. There's a good size preview of it you can look through, and if that doesn't change your mind, then nothing will. So,
I don't want to say you have something wrong with you if you look at this and don't want it, but you might have something wrong with you if you look at a preview and you're not like, I need to order that.
Like I said, hopefully the Jim Aparo book is on the top of my pile as well. Okay. So work on that as progressing. Yeah, so at a good place. So
okay.
Hopefully that will be out, like I said, late summer, early fall kind of release.
All right. Again, I don't know if you can hear that, but I'm knocking the I'm knocking the wooden desk as I as you said.
Whatever, if you got a fully clever, you can send me or put a horseshoe up for me. I don't know. Whatever you can do, I'd appreciate it.
Okay. Jim.
Yes.
What can we see from you coming out in the next couple of months?
the stuff I'm doing for Archie Comics. I do Sonic Universe, and I do Life with Archie. I did a 4-issue Reggie and Me series, which is in the digital format only. And I'm going to have a story in the New Crusaders, that Archie's putting out with the old all the characters have been updated, so I'll be doing a story there too. I should be getting those pages pretty soon. So that's and plus, I'm still associated with Alter Ego. I'm not currently doing any interviews.
Well, we do have that Perlin interview in the can.
Yeah, that's right.
That should be an Alter Ego probably this summer sometime or towards the end of the year maybe.
Okay. And Alter Ego is monthly or bimonthly?
Eight times a year.
So sometimes it's monthly, sometimes it's bimonthly. It depends on what issue.
That's why, that's what eight times a year means.
Like, we'll get it to you when we can get it to you, and when you look back on it, it'll be eight times a year, but it might not necessarily be in any sort of...
No, it's not a regular schedule.
That's a regular schedule.
It's a regular schedule.
Regular eight times a year.
Where's my will? Why this strange desire that keeps mounting higher when I look at you? I can't keep still. You're